This program is supported by grants from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers, and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It is Friday, January 2nd, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It is time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning we're taking your calls about geeky things, computer setups, what to buy, comments on technology. Be a part of this morning's Geek Speak by calling 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then send a message. I could just listen to that all morning. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, Program and Student of American Literature, and Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta Geeks. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning, Lyle.
Morning, Lyle.
So, this morning we are taking calls all morning long. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800 if you'd like to join us. But while we wait for your calls, Miles and Sean have brought a little bit of news for us today, and we'll get a little bit of information on what's going on in the world of the geek. Miles?
Apparently, the end of the BIOS is nigh.
Now, what does BIOS stand for?
Basic Input Output System, I believe.
And what is it really about?
When you start up your computer, when it's doing that memory check, when it's saying, you have this hard drive and a CD-ROM drive and these controllers and these serial ports and parallel ports, that's the BIOS doing it.
Or when the Macintosh is showing a little happy, smiling Mac, which is equivalent to some degree.
Well, actually, it's not quite the same.
Well, no, the first stage of seeing the little happy Mac is the BIOS doing it.
You really can't do it. It's really an apples and oranges thing.
Okay.
Because the Mac has a lot of stuff in RAM that are based. That's for the operating system. Everything on the Mac is based on booting the Macintosh operating system.
Right.
Whereas the BIOS on a PC is very operating system agnostic.
Okay.
So the PC is the orange. And the apples and oranges.
Well, the BIOS actually is the lemon. But
so on the PC, the BIOS is the first thing you see. So when you actually see that you're running an Intel or AMD processor of this speed, and then it starts counting your memory. That's
right.
Your BIOS.
It's the thing responsible for also starting up other things.
And why do you need it? BIOS and like,
it's, well, it was needed for the original PC for booting DOS, because DOS was a glorified program loader, very, very simple operating system. And so it needed information from the BIOS as to what it could do, like how to talk to a hard drive, how to do a wide variety of basic functions. Whereas modern operating systems rely on their own set of drivers for running different components, so the BIOS has become redundant in many ways. All it does is slow down the boot process.
And which is very much the case with newer OSs, Mike.
Right. As newer Windows OSs are booting much faster, but you still have to wait that initial time when starting the computer.
Yep.
So Intel has started a new initiative called EFI. Shoot, I've just now lost what EFI stood for. Extensible Firmware Interface. And the idea behind that, it was supposed to be very modular, have a very basic core, and operating systems and hardware manufacturers, more specifically, could write in hooks, hardware hooks, to be able to tell it exactly how it's supposed to be booting up. The device would tell it how to boot it,
okay,
as it were, to initialize it, I should say. What this was supposed to do is basically streamline the whole booting process and get rid of a lot of the 23 years of cruft that the BIOS has taken up.
Okay. So the general concept then is there'd be a protocol that the hardware would take care of, and then you would specify which device is the bootable device, and then that bootable device would actually kind of have an understanding about the hardware?
Well, how you would access the device is what actually gets told. The BIOS will tell you, oh, that's a fixed device, fixed storage, like a hard drive, and I'm going to have this one first and this one. But it doesn't take that long to do it. What you're looking at is 23 years of hack upon hack upon hack
to build
having to maintain backward compatibility.
Okay.
If you get rid of that backward compatibility and only make it for the newest components, because you don't have to deal with ISA slots anymore, those big black slots that are in older computers, you only have to deal with plug-and-play devices, PCI devices, AGP. A lot of that plug-and-play has already been done. A lot of that device initialization has already been done. So you can streamline the process and also make way for newer hooks to go in there.
Right, make things easier. Okay, well, thank you for that very geeky explanation of BIOS and what the replacement will be. Sean?
Well, there's good news on the horizon for the semiconductor industry. IDC, one of the larger market researcher firms, has predicted that revenue will grow at a compound annual rate of 12.5% between 2003 and 2008. So it's rising from about $160 billion in 2003 to $282 billion in 2008. So I think that's what people wanted to hear. Not quite as high as it's been in the past, but still much higher than they figured it would be. And they expect revenue will grow by 18% to about $190 billion in 2004. So $160 to $190, it's not bad.
Yeah, I'm sure that's
And the SIA, another forecast, analyst firm that does a bunch of forecasts, very similar to IDC, has predicted the same thing, about $163 billion in 2003 to about $195 billion. So theirs are even a little higher.
Okay, so growth in 2004, in the next few years.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sean. Miles?
A couple of recycling stories. One has to do with PC recycling, a topic we've covered on the show before, which is a lot of laws of the land are coming up, specifically in Massachusetts and California. You have laws making it illegal to dump many computer parts into a landfill. This is, of course, because computer parts have many toxic chemicals many times. They have a lot of heavy metals, mercury, CRTs, or rather computer monitors, have a bunch of lead in them, the lead to keep any electromagnetic radiation off of.
Quite a bit, actually.
It's all mostly in the front grill to keep you from getting irradiated while watching your solitaire game.
And this lead makes bad things happen in landfills?
Well, lead's a bad thing to have in your water table, yes.
Yeah, it causes, and mercury.
Yeah. What was it? Causes retardation in children? Is that it? Anyway, I digress. Well, with these initiatives going on, people have a hard time getting rid of older equipment. For the first time, LCDs have overtaken CRTs. In other words, flat panel displays have taken over from the TV-style computer monitor. And so a bunch of people have these computer monitors that they want to get rid of. And you have older computers. People are getting a new computer every 3 years or so. So what do you do with these older computers? One place to take them is IBM, but IBM will only take things that are called marketable. The marketable ones meaning that the product still has to be relatively modern, still has to be able to run modern software.
They have to be able to sell it, basically.
Right.
Now, this is a program that IBM has initiated?
Yeah, except you have to pay shipping costs to get it back to them.
And how do you go about...
How do you play?
Yeah. Is it through their website?
It's not clear right here whether or not this is IBM-only equipment or whether it's everything, but considering IBM's been fairly technology-agnostic in the last few years, I would assume it was anything that's worth a try. Basically, they offer minimum specifications on their website and will deliver individual quotes based on the information you provide about the equipment. But there are things like CRT monitors below 19 inches won't be purchased back.
Really? Even if they're functional?
Yeah, your old 14-inch monitor, sorry.
Or even 17.
Right. Yeah. Which, you know, I have a problem with because I have a 14-inch monitor. I'm like, I need to get rid of this. It works perfectly fine.
Well, in line of this, Maggie, our producer, did a little contact for us this morning for the Recycling Coalition in Santa Cruz County. I'm not sure exactly the body of that, but they sent a wonderful Word document to us, and I think I'll have to publish this information on our website later today. Basically, it's Santa Cruz County e-waste recycling program. The concept is that most household products that work after you're done using them, really, they're still functional, old monitors, things of that nature. There's a group of community partners that are actually interested in taking those prior to recycling them, but actually reusing them, which is a good thing. And there's a whole list of them. Gateway Business and Community Coalition, Inc., they're in Watsonville. The Spot in Watsonville. Dave's Computers in Santa Cruz. MC Squared in Soquel. Seabreeze Computers in Watsonville. Gentner Computer in Santa Cruz. Goodwill will take stuff as well. They accept working TVs under 25 inches, color monitors, 486s and newer computers for resale. So Goodwill's always been a good company for taking that kind of stuff. California Gray Bears of Live Oak. So there's just a whole list of companies out there that go, yeah, we'll take your stuff if you want to get rid of it. And it's much better than dumping it at, a recycling center, because, of course, it's so expensive to do that, especially if it's functional.
And also, speaking of gadgetry, it's not just computers. You can also take back cell phones, old cell phones, because people are constantly going through them, and they'll still work, but you got to have that new model, so what do you do with the old one?
Right. In a lot of cases, you'll be charged to get rid of a CRT monitor.
That's right.
Taking it to one of these places is saving money.
If it's big enough. As they say, it might be that they won't take a 15-incher.
Right. Yeah, general cost for taking back CRT is $25.
I believe that's correct. So I'll post this information. We'll get a little bit more information on geekspeak.org. That will help us out.
We should probably contact City Waste to see what...
Maggie did that and got this coalition.
Do they talk about the charges for...
I don't have that information in front of me.
Taking away smaller monitors, yeah.
We did get an email from through our website, which is geekspeak.org. Click on The Geeks and then click on Send a Message. And just a Happy New Year from Joe Vela. Thank you very much, Joe.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right.
Happy better year.
Let's go on to the next. So the recycling, it's always an issue, especially with technology. I feel so bad with my gadgets. I normally don't recycle stuff. I just keep it in my home, and I've got a kind of pile of stuff.
Yes, you do, Lyle.
I don't recycle either. I just give it to you. Speaking of which, I have some stuff to give you.
Oh, good. cell phones, old cell phones. Kids love them. And they're really
that's right. We gave your son one of our old cell phones.
I hadn't even thought about that. I have my nice big brick of a Sprint PCS cell phone from 6 years ago.
I don't think a child could hold that, Miles. It's too heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, the thing is, when you have a cell phone like that, it is going to be contacting a transmitter every once in a while. And it does use the battery. And that means it's transmitting. And, of course, that means you've got more transmission happening in your home.
And it's zapping brain cells.
That's assuming that the battery is in there and actually charged.
Oh, you got to have the battery in there or the kid's not going to want to play with it. You got the lights come on and the whole thing. Maybe I'll rip out the transmitter.
There you go.
The phone. That's a good idea. Make it safer for what? Next news item, Sean.
The DVD format wars continue. The two sides have been lobbing bombs at each other for quite a while. There's the Plus RW camp and the Dash RW camp.
And if I want to buy one, what do I want to buy?
You should probably take a look at the hardware that you currently have to see what format is best compatible.
No, if I want to buy a new DVD burner.
That's the thing. So let's say you wanted to burn some DVD movies that you made on your home camera. You want it to be compatible with your DVD
player. Oh, I see what you're saying.
With your television. Well, if your DVD player doesn't support Plus RW, which is typically the case, then you want to get the Dash RW. So you have to do a little investigation. That seems to be... what's been happening, but newer DVD players and DVD hardware for computers, both readers and writers, have been supporting both standards. One is better than the other, actually. I don't know how geeky you want to get, but Plus RW is better for data. So if you're using a computer and you want to back up your data, Plus RW is going to burn faster, and it's going to be a better format for storing your data over
Doesn't
a long period of time.
A little bit more, too?
And it stored a little bit more.
Yeah. Then again, for ultimate compatibility with DVD players, you do the DVD-R.
The Dash-R will give you the most compatibility, even with computer DVD readers, DVD-ROM drives. -RW is going to give you the most compatibility, especially if you have a first or second generation.
I was thinking of -R.
Yes, that's -R, -RW.
Sorry.
So -R is a read format.
It's a write once read.
And RW is a rewritable. So what's happening now is
rewritable makes sense for DVDs because they're kind of expensive still.
They are kind of expensive.
And it definitely makes sense on the concept of reuse and recycle rather than
like
one
a stack of 25 DVD -R.
Yeah, so the guys who just told me earlier, oh, I have a whole bunch of CDRs. They're so cheap. I just throw them away.
Well,
I wasn't involved in that conversation.
CDs hold 650 megs and DVDs hold 4.7 gigs. Now, what's happening is the Plus RW camp, the DVD Plus RW, is moving to a double layer standard that can now hold 16 hours of VHS quality video or 8.5 gigabytes of data. So they'll be the first ones to get to that double layer.
And will new hardware be needed to read?
Yeah, you'll need new hardware to read this. So when you're buying a drive, consider, you know, the future because new types of writing standards are coming out. And that's going to be out in spring. The -R and -RW camp will be getting the same thing. And the way it works is it's think dual layer recording involves writing data to two separate surfaces, like coats of paint. So if you look at DVD discs now that you buy with movies on them, the ones that are gold on the bottom, those are dual layer discs. So your DVD player automatically will be able to read those. DVD drive should be able to read those. I would think that the -R, -RW standard is going to be the most compatible, just like it was previously. But we'll have to wait and see.
Well, thank you very much for that information, Sean and Miles as well. We're going to take a quick break, take a call. But we do have some more news. Is that correct, gentlemen?
Yep.
Good.
I'm done.
You're done? Oh, good. Well, let's go ahead and go to Dennis in Santa Cruz. Dennis, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Hello?
Yes, you're on air.
Okay, just a very naive question. I was concerned about, this business of downloading music from the internet. And I was wondering why cryptography can't be used to counteract that, or if it is.
Meaning
that
what?
You encrypt the encrypt your stuff so that anyone who downloads it gets junk.
Well, okay, you can. It's actually quite easy to encrypt data. What's happening right now is you'll have someone taking music CDs and what's called ripping them, which basically means encoding them in a smaller format onto their hard drive. Normally MP3 is the most common. And they store that music, and then they want to share that music with a whole bunch of other people. So they'll upload it to a server that's readily available, and then other people can download it. It's about the sharing of information, which happens to be copyrighted, and that's where the problem comes in.
Well, sometimes it is.
People intentionally put it on the internet so that other people can get it for free.
Yeah, when reputable companies encode music, they do some sort of encryption, just like Apple does with iTunes, so that other people can't steal that music without paying for it. But the problem is the pirate software pirates, hackers, and so on, who are going out and encoding the music themselves, are doing it in such a way that anybody can read it, and they're the ones who are sharing this stuff out there.
Okay.
And causing the problem.
Does that make sense, Dennis?
I guess I'm very naive about these things. I just was curious.
Yeah, the basic concept is that people are trying to share music for free, and that's why there's downloading of music online for free. Then there is the paid services, and in that situation, the companies that are doing that are trying to protect the copyright's interest.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I mean, for example, I write music. I don't know if I'd ever get around to doing anything like putting it on the net, but if I did, I might not want people to just download.
Right. So you would actually be the copyright owner in that case, and it would be up to you when you put the music up. But let's say you then made a CD and you distributed the CD, and one of the people that purchased the CD could then copy that music to the internet,
okay,
and other people could download it. So you would lose the control of your right to that music.
That's right.
And that's basically what's happening. Now, I know a lot of musicians that actually, local bands and stuff, they're putting up their music on their sites for free, and people can download it, because right now they are trying to make a name for themselves, and they want to have a large audience base so that they can get sold into the music industry and tour better and all that. So the sharing of music is not necessarily a bad marketing ploy for musicians. It right now is the music industry doesn't like it because it's very challenging to their way of making money.
Okay.
Thank you, Dennis, very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
I was thinking with regards to encryption over peer-to-peer protocols, you also have the added CPU overhead and your downloads will go slower.
That's
because
true.
You have the encryption overhead.
If you're just sharing from
as
home.
As a practical note, yeah.
Definitely. All right, our next news item, Sean. And you know what? Let me just mention to everybody that's listening, if you're welcome to call in with your computer questions and comments. Call in about a question like Dennis just did about music downloading. You can, of course, call and ask us how to set up an external drive or how to burn a CD. We'd love to help you out. We can cover pretty much any OS today on Geek Speak with Miles, Sean, myself, Lyle. We also got an email from using our website, geekspeak.org. Click on the geeks and then click on send a message from Sarah, who's looks like a UCSC person. Currently, Sarah uses a PowerBook G4, and she's planning on purchasing an external hard drive for use in storing a significant amount of scanned images. She's wondering, first, which external hard drives we would recommend in 80 gigabyte range, in the 80 gigabyte range. And secondly, if we have an opinion on specific decision about USB 2 versus FireWire, specifically her G4 does not have FireWire. I didn't know that there were any PowerBook G4s that didn't have FireWire. I thought they all had FireWire. But she does have USB 2. So the question is, what she should be looking at. Now, Sean, you're kind of the external drive expert. I know you're not a Mac expert, but you got an opinion on this?
Well, we did a news story a few weeks ago on Panther.
Yeah.
And a problem with installing it if you had an external hard drive connected. Remember, it zapped all your data?
Yeah.
And it happened to be LISC hard drives.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was zapping the, it was making the FireWire drive inaccessible.
So not inaccessible, it was deleting the data.
Right. Well, it was destroying something on it. So basically, make sure that you're never have an external drive connected when you're installing, unless you really know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But that has been fixed. Make sure everything's patched up before you use this drive.
It probably has been patched up, but there might be stores out there still selling the drive, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have the right version of the software. So just be careful of that. But, yeah, like you said, disconnect drives before you install or upgrade software. But otherwise, I've heard LISC is very very good company.
Yeah.
I've never used their drives. I did, actually, back in, like, 97 or 98. But I have used Mac Store's external drives.
And this is an important thing to note. Sarah, you don't need to get a Mac-specific external drive. You can pretty much get any FireWire or USB 2 external drive, and it will work on your Mac, especially if you're running OS X. It won't have any problems.
And it's Apple pretty much, with the launch of the iMac, has been pushing USB and FireWire, USB 2 and FireWire, mostly FireWire. And these companies have been putting these types of external products out because of Apple. So they're definitely Apple-compatible. I mean, take a look at the box. It should tell you. Anything in the 80, 100 gigabyte drive range right now is kind of the sweet spot. So I think that's where you're going to find the best price. And that's a pretty large size drive, so that can probably, fit most people's needs. I've heard that Seagate is going to be coming out with an external hard drive solution too. So, but right now, if you go to Fry's, typically you see Mac Store.
Yeah, Mac Store's kind of the de facto.
Yeah, and let's see. I don't see them anywhere. So.
Yeah. I think that they're marketing much more to Macintosh and Intel, so they're in Mac magazines and such. Now, Sean, you wrote an article. It's actually on GeekSpeak still, geekspeak.org, down the line on a Mac Store external drive. And
it was their 80 gig stuff. Solution.
It's pretty geeky and pretty rich, but it's definitely what she's talking about. Now, one other thing, I just kind of reread the end of her email, and I didn't understand that Sarah doesn't currently support USB 2.0, only USB. So the question is, should she get a USB 2 drive? Or is that kind of redundant?
Oh, no. It, it,